We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dead on the air. We're dead on the air.
Welcome to Dads on the Air for the 12th of August 2008. In the studio with us, we've got Philip York from Dads in Distress.
Good morning, and we also have Purdy from IanPurdy.com. Sorry, Ian.
That's all right, Phil. Thanks, mate. No, that's okay. And of course, we have one of the founding fathers of the Dads on the Air team, John Stapleton.
Thank you. Interesting show coming up. We'd like to welcome everyone from around the world who's joining us via live streaming on the 2GLF website. And don't forget, you can listen to this program later at www.dadsontheair.net. Got a great show coming up. We've got Kathleen Parker. She's the author of a new book, Save the Males, which is creating a furor right around the world. And we'll also have Peter Burns, who's an activist over in New Zealand who knows very full well the damage the state can do to individuals. Or for Kathleen Parker, as we said, has created quite a considerable amount of controversy with her new book, Save the Males. She's so disenfranchised of men become that only a woman can state the bleeding obvious, that the extreme sexism of gender feminism has done a great deal of harm to men, women and children and society as a whole. For her pains, she has attracted vicious criticism from the feminist pack. We'll also be talking, as we said, with Peter Burns from New Zealand, who has been to court more than 200 times to write false allegations, proving that the family law system is just as appalling and just as discriminatory in New Zealand as it is in Australia. Kathleen Parker.
Kiwi in a suit.
Kiwi in a suit.
Good Been Lord. To court 200 times, yes.
200 times, my goodness.
Suit must be getting pretty worn.
Kathleen Parker, yes, because he couldn't have been able to afford more than one. Kathleen Parker argues that feminism has neutered men and deprived them of their noble, protective role in society. Writing in the Times of London, she said, "I know. Saving the males is an unlikely vocation for a 21st century woman. Most men don't know they need saving. Most women consider the idea absurd. When I tell my women friends that I want to save the males, they look at me as if noticing for the first time that I am insane. Then they say something like, 'Are you out of your mind? This is still a male-dominated world. It's women who need saving. Screw the men.' Actually, that's a direct quote. The reality is that men have already been screwed, and not in the way they prefer.
No.
For the past 30 years or so, males have been under siege by a culture that too often embraces the notion that men are to blame for all of life's ills. Males as a group, not random men, are bad by virtue of their DNA. While women have been cast as victims, martyrs, mystics or saints, men have quietly retreated into their caves, the better to muffle the emotions that fluctuate between hilarity, are these bitches crazy or what? And rage, yes they are, and they've got our kids. In the process of fashioning a more female-friendly world, we have created a culture that is hostile towards male, contemptuous of masculinity, and cynical about the delightful differences that make men irresistible, especially when something goes bump in the night. In popular culture, rare is the man portrayed as wise, strong and noble. In film and music, men are variously portrayed as dolts, bullies, brutes, deadbeats, rapists, sexual predators and wife beaters. Even otherwise easygoing family men in sitcoms are invariably cast as, at best, bumbling, dim-witted fools. One would assume from most depictions that the smart, decent man who cares about his family and pats the neighbourhood dog is the exception rather than the rule." That should be a really interesting interview. And we've also got coming up in the coming weeks, and really keep an eye out for this, the author of Fathering in the Tips for Fathers, Adult Daughters, Husbands and Father Figures. Kevin Rudd, the Prime Minister of Australia, said fathers and daughters need each other. A dad can give a daughter a special confidence and sense of her own value in a very special way. A strong father-daughter bond helps a daughter navigate through the many tough challenges of the teenage years and early adulthood. And that should be a really interesting book. And don't forget, we'll have Bruce Robertson on in the coming weeks, Daughters and Their Dads, Tips for Fathers. And, of course, as we often do, Dads on the Air would not be Dads on the Air without mention of the beloved Child Support Agency.
Absolutely, John. And this week has been no different than the previous weeks. Child support has been in the headlines again. Apparently, they've done an analysis on the impacts of the new system. And the Courier Mail, Renee writes, taxpayers will foot the bill for the dramatic overhaul of the child support system, which has left more money in the pockets of paying parents. The government yesterday released a report revealing 49% of parents who receive less money in child support from paying parents, but the majority of parents who receive less money will have a boost in income under the family tax benefit. Overall, 192,600 parents, or 33%, will have to pay more money in child support. From the Canberra Times, it reads, "The poorest parents lose in new child support plan." And it's by Stephanie Peatling. "More than half of the poorest parents will receive up to $20 a week less in child support payments because of changes to the scheme. Nearly half of the parents who pay child support, 51%, but 33% will pay less." Sorry about that. "The changes respond to trends towards increased shared parenting and recognise that when care of a child is shared, the costs are also shared," the Minister for Human Services, Joe Ludwig, and Minister for Family and Community Services, Jenny Macklin, said.
Really interesting to note that we have asked five times now for Joe Ludwig to come on the show, and we've been completely ignored. Whether he likes it or not, we are the country's leading father's show, and if there was any genuine concern to communicate these changes to separated dads, he should come on the show.
Absolutely. Couple of articles in yesterday's and today's paper. I'll kick off with the one from yesterday's paper, yesterday's Telegraph, written by David Barrett and Peter Gosnell, under the heading "Struggling Families Facing Tough Times." And they write, "With two credit cards and a hefty home loan, Scott and Samantha Downey know how they'll spend their $5,000 baby bonus. That'll probably go straight onto the credit card," Mrs. Downey told the Daily Telegraph yesterday. "Ideally, we'd like to be able to put it into a savings account, but that's not going to happen. Life is really tough for families at the moment." That said, Mrs. Downey, "As a small business owner with two young daughters, including two-week-old Maggie, Scott Downey said high interest rates had hit the family hard. We manage, but we work very, very hard," Mr. Downey said. "The home loan repayments take a big chunk out of the family budget." Mrs. Downey said the couple faced high interest rates on their two credit cards, which they used to pay bills for electricity, water and other utilities. "Last year, Mr. Downey reduced the limit for one of the cards from $10,000 to $5,000. The credit cards are maxed out and there's no savings," he said. He said many families were stuck in a cycle of debt and struggling to meet their repayments. "That can put pressure on your marriage, your family and your life. If you can't manage, then the pressure can tear a family apart," he said. Which leads on to this article, which actually appeared in yesterday's Australian, Matthew Warren, under the heading "Divorce Breeds Environmental Degradation," has written, "Domestic breakups multiply the energy used and garbage produced by family. Divorce is not just heartbreaking, it's bad for the environment. When a couple or family separates, they create two households where there used to be one. Suddenly the same number of people are using twice the number of hot water systems, two refrigerators, two kitchens, two heaters, and two air conditioners. If there are kids, then sometimes each child inherits two bedrooms instead of one. It's like a mini fiscal expansion. Separation puts upward pressure on the rental market, and it's a boom for suppliers of furnishings and electrical goods like Harvey Norman and Bing Lee. But it's a much less efficient way to live. A four-person family that breaks up will generate around 43% more garbage than they did when they were together. They will use up to 34% more water and up to 70% more energy, depending on the type of new dwellings being occupied. It's not a trivial problem. Around 40% of marriages will end in divorce. If governments want to improve environmental performance, maybe they should start recruiting marriage counsellors." So writes Matthew Warren in yesterday's Australian. And basically what the first article says is that families aren't coping. They are being driven to divorce by the pressures of the economy, home loans, credit card interest rates, etc. Of course, fuel, food, everything's gone up ridiculously. And once The family is torn apart by these pressures. They're in a far worse position because suddenly their expenses are doubled, and not only do they produce more environmental pollution, use 70% more energy, they are that much worse off because they've got to basically refurbish another house, another kitchen, another refrigerator, you know, another heater, another everything, double up on all that stuff that they used to have. They've now got to buy it again. They've got to pay more rent if they're renting. One of them will have to rent, or they've got to buy a new place, so the mortgage payments double. I think that's unlikely in today's world that families breaking up, one partner is able to go and buy a second home. Usually it puts one partner, usually the father, the male party, in the position of having to become a renter, which is not pleasant. So as you can see, there's not a lot of light at the end of the tunnel for families, and for families that have broken up at the moment. We'll be back in a moment.
Have Kathleen Parker, the American author of Save the Males, on the line. Are you there, Kathleen?
I am here, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air. Sorry about
My
the little
pleasure.
Sound kerfuffle there. Look, dear.
It's I was here all along. It was okay.
Oh, that's all right.
Oh, yes, little faith.
Oh, yes. Well, your book is causing quite a fuss all around the world, so I think we should start right at the beginning. Where did the idea come from, and why did you write the book Save the Males?
Well, I'm two things. I'm the daughter of a father, and I'm the mother of sons. So my dad raised me after my mother died when I was very young, and my son, I have three boys who are now adults, but I've, you know, throughout the course of raising them, I became increasingly aware that the culture was becoming increasingly anti-male and hostile toward my innocent boys. And my experience with men has been fairly positive. I don't view them as monsters or inhuman, and yet we seem to treat them as though they were. So I thought, well, you know, somebody's got to say it. And as a woman, I could say much more easily some of the things I did. Men would never get away with it. Well, let's put it this way. Men have been saying it all along, but they're not heard in the same way that a woman can be heard.
Oh, no.
So anyway, that's why I wrote it.
Yes, we've made that
point.
I'm
a glutton for fairness.
Good on you. Oh, yes, I ridicule people who use this phrase, but I think I agree with everything you say.
Yeah, well, no, you're bound to.
Terrific.
You're bound to. It's interesting, this book has gotten much more attention in Britain and Australia and Canada than in the U.S.
Oh, really?
It's almost as though I'm invisible and nobody's paid any attention, even though it's pretty hard to ignore me over here. But it seems that men and women are just simply more responsive in these other countries. And I don't know if that's because you're further along in recognizing the problems or more eager to hear it. I don't know. I haven't quite figured that out.
We are, in Australia particularly, we can have both the European and the American influences, so we're often called what we're called early adopters. You know, they test out technology on us and that sort of thing, because we tend to pick up things very quickly here, so maybe it'd be nice to think we were.
Yeah, well, and on the other hand, you all have some of the more draconian measures in place that are anti-male, in my view. Such as the airline policy that won't let a man sit next to an unaccompanied child by virtue of the fact that he's a man. And, of course, we know that men are inevitably pedophiles or abusers in some fashion. And so we have to protect men and women and children from their very proximity.
That's amazing, isn't it? So you don't have
it's frightening. And, I mean, it's insane. If this were happening to women, if women were being discriminated against in the same way that men are, well, there would be riots in the street and conferences and international symposia called. So men are the class of people that can now be bashed with immunity.
Oh, one of the obsessions of this program has been the death rate of child support payers, which we believe is running at more than 12 a day. If it was in this country alone, now if they were women dying, there would have been royal commissions and inquiries, and the whole agency would have been shut down long ago.
That's right. That's exactly right. And that's true here as well, and pretty much across the board, I think. There seems to be some idea of retributive justice in these policies and the pursuit of men, the assumption of their badness, that, look, men have been in control for thousands of years, and now it's our turn meaning women's turn. And interestingly, these policies that have been put in place that are so harmful to men and so destructive to the family have been put in place by men primarily, because men are, you know, they still control the Congress over here anyway. And my theory on that is that men just tend to not want to be contrary. You know, if women want something, they typically say, well, okay, that's whatever you want, dear, and hand it over. And it takes a few decades, I guess, for things to start coming into focus where they realize that what they've done is actually not helpful, not only not helpful to men, but not helpful to women and children in the long run.
Oh, yes, it's really noticeable to us that men do not support other men. Men, for instance, married men do not support separated men. They just regard them as an embarrassment. You know, there must have been something wrong with you, mate, or, you know, get over it, you know. whereas a separated woman is the subject of enormous sympathy and the entire state.
Right, because obviously steps in behind she's victimized them. By the old man, right?
Yes, of course.
Obviously, because women are always victims and men are always aggressors. That's what we know. Well, now, I forgot, I left out a piece of my resume, which is, yes, my father raised me after my mother died. He also remarried four more times.
Yes, so I noticed that. Frequently married. Yes.
Well, he was just criminally handsome. You know, they
could obviously a tiger for punishment as well.
So I got to see it up close, and what I realized was, I mean, and by the way, I loved all my mothers, and I'm good friends with all of them. He's dead, poor thing.
Yes.
But I guess five wives would
worn out.
So anyway, my point is that in observing these relationships, I mean, I was certainly aware that my father was imperfect.
Mm.
We, you know, perfection can't be our standard. But I also know that they weren't, and I also know that he was a good soul and worked hard and tried to be a good father and tried to be responsible to his relationships. And, you know, it's not a one-way street. There's no real villain or victim in a marriage. And so the ultimate goal needs to be that we work together. Not all marriages are worth preserving, but the children deserve to have both a parent, mother and a father. They don't divorce one or the other. And unless there's compelling evidence to preclude that ongoing relationship, then there should be no excuse for denying it.
Yes, of course, this whole victimhood business carries on right through the entire divorce industry. How much harm do you think it's doing women themselves being cast as victims like this?
Yeah, well, it's not fair to anyone. Now, I will say, you know, I'm presenting all of this from the man's point of view because that was my thesis, was that the world is unfair to men. And that's not to say the world is not also, in other ways, unfair to women or that there aren't, you know, years and years and years of examples where women have been treated unfairly by the system.
Mm.
I just simply propose that it doesn't make it any better for women to also be unfair. I mean, to, you know, if you look at history, the oppressed typically becomes the oppressor, and we seem to think that being just as bad as the worst man ever was is somehow justified, and I just simply reject that.
I think it's quite incredible. What sort of reaction are you getting around the world for the book?
Well, it's been so interesting. In this, you know, I've gotten a few reviews, and they have not been awful. You know, that's what I expected. I expected awful. Not because the book is badly written or not fun to read, because it is, I think. It was fun to write, but because I'm presenting ideas that are not popular. But I did try to do it in a way that was not, you know, it's not an anti-feminist screed. In fact, I confess to being a feminist myself, just simply, but I identify, the way I define that is somewhat different than the current zeitgeist.
Yes.
My definition is simply equal rights under the law.
Mm.
Equal opportunity by merit where it benefits society. There are cases, I think, where it doesn't benefit society for there to be absolute equality. So that said, obviously the radical feminists are not liking it much. They have a lot invested in gender neutrality and gender blending. Men are pretty much appreciative, but they're also, you know, a little bit miffed that it took a woman to get to be heard, because you know, I've been involved with the fathers movement for 20 years, and I know how hard many of them have worked and how sad many of them are and feel that they've made little progress. And it's sort of, it's insulting, you know, I can see that. It's insulting that, oh, well, a woman comes along and says it and it's okay, you know. So I get a little bit of that. For the most part, I would say appreciative. Got a great review in the UK. You probably saw that.
Oh, yes. I might just read a couple of sentences from it. This is from Amanda Pertell writing in the UK's Daily Mail. Oh, yes. Why wouldn't you? Every once in a while.
But see, for a woman to say, I mean, this is the kind of woman that I was.
Yes.
20 years ago, where I was fair-minded, open-minded, and said, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. And she's, you know, she's one of those. She's able to see it, so I'm grateful for that.
Yeah, she wrote, I'll just give us a bit of a flavour of this. Every once in a while, a book not so much lands on your desk as lobs itself like a hand grenade, exploding preconceived wisdoms and shattering the bones of the status quo. Save the Males is such a book. It is the fiercest... It is the fiercest and most fearless defence of men, fatherhood, and ultimately the family I have read in many years. American author Kathleen Parker's courageous thesis is that initially for extreme feminism, then via its craven implementation into society, women have demonised men and trivialised their contribution, especially to family life. I say courageous because in the eyes of many women and of the liberal establishment, suggesting men have had a rough deal is nothing short of heresy. But of course...
Yeah, well, you know what? I've been dealing with those people for 20 years. I mean, really, I'm a columnist, have been a columnist for 20 years, and I've been writing about these issues all those years. And so I'm very familiar with the arguments that would come at me, and my skin is sufficiently thick to take it. But also, it's very easy for me. I frankly, you know, they say courageous and fierce and all that. I don't see it that way at all. It's common sense. It's so easy for me, and I don't see it as being in any way radical or gosh, I can't believe she had the nerve to say that, you know, because it's so true. It's all true. And and our deathbed moments when we put our head down on that pillow, there is no argument against the simple points I make, and I really toned it down, by the way. That's not nearly as fierce as I feel.
Really?
Well, I went through a mainstream publisher and went through quite a gauntlet of feminist editors who kept, you know, tugging on the choke collar to get me to be sort of more relaxed, and so that's the sweet version.
Really, it's so true, though, isn't it? So much of these organisations and institutions are now controlled by feminist, either feminist women or indeed feminist men.
Oh yeah, worse, feminist men. Oh my gosh, is there a scarier person in the world? Let me say this:
we've got a few of them in Australia, believe me.
No, I'm sure you do. I can spot them. I can spot them walking down the street. But here's the giveaway. Here's when you know something's wrong. When social science goes out of its way to prove that fathers are not necessary to their children, then anybody with half a brain has to say, wait a minute, what's up with this? There's something wrong here. There's got to be something else going on. There's an agenda here. And what is it? Because why would anybody want to prove that? You know? I mean, of course children are better off without a bad father, just as they're better off without a bad mother. But to try to prove that they're simply not necessary and that children just do fine without, in fact, some children do better without, seems to me suggestive of something else going on that bears our scrutiny.
So why did this ideology take over the institutions so rapidly and so dramatically? How has it influenced Western thought so fundamentally?
Well, I think it started out, it's very hard to talk about feminism as one entity, I think, because there are lots of different gradations, and not all are so completely off the wall, but the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and I think it started out that women wanted to participate more fully in the culture, and I have no problem with that. You know, I mean, I wanted to have a career. I wanted to use my brain. I wanted to do things that were interesting, but not to the exclusion of also being a good mother. Now, when I was a young person in college, I didn't know that I would feel this way ever. In fact, I doubt seriously that I could have imagined that I would end up writing this book at that time. But you know, let's say, when you're in college, you're young and you don't know anything. You don't have any life experience, and so you're sort of absorbing everything that's tossed your way, and I was receptive. But when I had a child, it all changed for me. It was very easy to see that there were some things not quite right in that message. But nonetheless, the feminist ideal of getting women out of the home, you know, became institutionalized in the colleges. And the idea seems to be that in order to escape the patriarchy, you have to eliminate the patriarch. And who is that but the father? And that became kind of the, not the spoken goal, at least not mainstream spoken goal. You can certainly find examples in the feminist literature suggesting exactly that, that men simply had to be eliminated from the equation and women needed to be completely self-sufficient. Then you combine, and that self-sufficiency is not necessarily wrong. You certainly want to encourage women to be productive members of society. Certainly they have to be able to pay their own bills until such time as they are married and, you know, in a relationship that allows them to be mothers. I mean, we're all messed up here, you understand. It's very confusing. Nobody knows exactly
It's
hard on men, it's hard on women, but at some point, somebody has to have the babies, and somebody has to take care of them. When my turn came, there was no question who that needed to be. I was a mother, and, you know, I needed to be with my baby. I couldn't imagine anybody else being with him. So, but at the same time, you have to have the father agreeing to those terms and recognizing the equity value in the mother being that person to her child. So, you know, it's very complicated. I mean, you add to that mix no-fault divorce and, you know, just everybody kind of abandoning the home, essentially, and women feeling that if they go home, not only are they giving up their autonomy, but they risk a great deal because should the divorce come through, should the marriage go south, then where are they left? I mean, they're left without a good job, a way to make a living, to take care of their children. So it's no single person's fault. I don't think it's even one ology's fault because we're all participants in it. It's simply a matter of recognizing that we've messed it up and we need to fix it. And it's both, you know, it's up to men and women to do that. It's not one person's fault.
No, it's not a result of a plan. It's just what happened. I mean, it's a whole bunch of...
It evolved. And we all kind of jumped on board. And it seemed like a good idea at the time.
Well, we could all see advantages for ourselves in the situation, you know, like for men, okay, if your family breaks up, you can go and have promiscuous sex, and, you know, same for women, I suppose. I mean, we could all see something in there that looked good for us, but we forgot about the children.
Exactly.
You know, and they're the ones who, and men and women suffer, but nothing like how our children are suffering with all this ridiculousness going on with family breakup.
Well,
and
parents,
you know,
used to stay together for the sake of the children. Then we decided that didn't matter anymore.
Yeah.
And I'm no longer convinced that that's true. I think, you know, we pat ourselves on the back and we say, well, look, as long as we're happy, the children will be happy. That's baloney.
Yeah, that's rubbish.
Fundamentally don't care if you're happy, but, you know, they just want mom and dad to come home every night, and they really don't even care if you get along.
Yeah, they want routine and security. That's what they want.
Exactly.
Somehow
we ought to be able to put up with each other for 18 or 20 years, don't you think?
I think I'm right to say the studies indicate also that people that do go through the weather the storms of those rocky times and do stay together often find that later in the marriage they're actually very happy with each other, that they can't quite remember what they were fighting back then. You know.
Well, it's true, and you know when they have young children and they're fighting, they're still pretty young themselves.
Yeah.
And they take very seriously every little thing, and what we do is we give up too soon.
But facing the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune together strengthens your relationship, strengthens the bond between you, rather than just folding, you know, as soon as trouble comes on the horizon, grab what you can and run for your life. I mean, it's just not the way to handle it. United we stand, divided we fall. It's a pretty old maxim, really.
We're talking with the American author Kathleen Parker. She is the author of a new book, Save the Males, which is creating quite a stir right around the world. We'll be back in a moment.
The greatest feeling I ever felt. Santa. He is the perfect child. Breaks the rules, calls me a fool. Then he turns and smiles. He's my boy, and I'm his daddy. I love him forever, love him madly. Cause he's my boy, pride and joy. Nothing can compare with holding his hand, running my fingers through his hair.
And we're talking with Kathleen Park, an American author whose book Save the Males is creating quite a stir right round the world. Welcome back to Dad's on the Air.
Thank you.
Now, you say that, basically you worked as a columnist and are really well aware of that great well of pain amongst separated men. Can you just talk about that and why their pain is just basically ignored?
You know, for 20 years or so, I've been writing about men and fathers and sort of following the fatherhood movement. I don't know how strong it is in Australia, but it kind of ebbs and flows here, and I think that's partly because men aren't very good at staying with an organization. Well, it's fairly loose anyway. It's all about, generally it's hurt fathers who are looking for somebody to talk to, and then eventually they dry their tears and move on, so the movement doesn't gain the momentum like the women's movement did. But, men are so marginalized from the family. And when people do get a divorce, typically the court sides with the mother. And, my sense of things is that there should be an assumption that the child continues to have both parents unless there's some reason why they shouldn't. And most of the time that wouldn't be the case. But even a perfectly wonderful father might wind up having access to his children only 4 days a month. And, that is alternating weekends. Now, I understand that it's not really very good for children, I don't think, to be moving back and forth between two households, and constantly having to kind of reorient to the home. But I also don't think there's any possible way to justify saying a father should only be a parent 4 days a month. So it comes back to this. It comes back to the, in my view, that the family court is really not the right place to solve these issues, because a court has to take a position, and it has to, divide up the bounty. I mean, look at our vocabulary when we talk about families. We talk about children as custody. And, in terms of parental rights and all of that, I mean, no one has a right here greater than the child's right to have both parents. So my sense is, first of all, I've been divorced, so I know what that's all about. It's you're not a sane person when you're going through a divorce. It's a completely discombobulating experience. You're in pain. You're psychologically in trouble, I would say. I would start to say deranged. But you're not in a position to make responsible decisions.
It brings out the absolute worst in people. It really does.
Absolutely. And then it becomes, this competition where someone has to win, which means someone has to lose. Obviously, it's the child who loses if the result is that he or she loses her father, and that's generally the case.
And the only person to win is the lawyer, generally, who makes money out of the whole
exactly.
thing.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I will say, when I got my divorce, my husband and I decided we would not involve the courts except to the extent, the minimal amount you have to. And we filled out, we hired the lawyer for a few a few hundred bucks, and we filled out I think our divorce decree was a page long, and that was that. There were no harsh feelings. And, I in fact even declined child support. They made me put down a figure because the judge said, you don't have a right to not deny your child support. And I said, yeah, but I don't really need it. I know how much he makes and how much I make. It's all fine. And he said, well, if you don't pick a a number I will. So I picked a low number, and that was it. And we didn't. I never have collected a penny. Now, I'm not suggesting that that's, everyone should do it that way. I'm just saying it can be done in a less acrimonious way. And two adults who once loved each other and who love a child together ought to be able to sit down and hash these things out without it becoming this brutal slugfest. And again, I'm assuming that we're talking about rational people. And if you're not rational at that point, and I always tell people, always, wait 2 years before you divorce. If you separate, wait 2 years. Because at the end of 2 years, you're no longer angry, and you can at least sit down to the table and figure it out in a way that doesn't damage everyone. But by all means, if you can, stay away from the court system. And maybe we need to just completely reconfigure how we handle these things. There was a wonderful judge in Florida who came up with an experimental program. I don't know where it went, but I wrote about him several years ago. And he was he had the same idea that I do, and he simply wouldn't let a couple come into his courtroom until they'd gone through some counseling and some, you know, out of court seeking out of court help from various professionals who could help them kind of reach a consensus that didn't force the judge to do something that was ultimately going to be more painful and more hurtful to everybody. So again, I want to put the burden back on the man and the woman to sort of say, look, we hate each other right this minute, but we didn't always, but we have these children who love us both, so let's figure it out. I mean, how hard is that? It's hard, but it's not impossible.
One of the difficulties here in Australia, which I assume is slightly similar there, is that for the parents to get, or particularly the mother to get a government payment, like a parenting payment, and at that time of separation you're often insecure about finances, they must apply for child support by law. So the agency is immediately involved and conflict is immediately generated.
Well, and you know what? My divorce was a long time ago, so I doubt that I could actually pull it off that way now, because, in fact, here, as I said, the judge insisted that I get child support, whether I wanted it or not. But at that time, it was a voluntary act by the, you know, the non-custodial parent to pay the child support to the custodial parent. So now all non-custodial parents are prejudged to be deadbeats. It's assumed that you will be a deadbeat, and so the government has stepped in, and now all child support goes through the state agency, and then it's distributed to the appropriate parent.
So it's the lowest common denominator. It's the lowest possible standard they can apply that gets applied.
Well, that's exactly right. Yeah. But everybody's incentivized, too. I mean, the state makes money by child support collections because they get some sort of matching funds from the federal government. The feds even step in and will give paternity tests and pay for various services that are aimed at collecting more child support. It's a big farce, and this, you know, the government likes to brag on, oh, well, we've really cracked down on deadbeats, and boy, we're getting all this money collected, as though they're helping. And the fact of the matter is, all they're doing is collecting money from mostly men who were and would pay their child support on time. And the deadbeat dad, in fact, the vast majority of them are people who have virtually no money. I think it's something like 70% in this country earn less than $10,000 a year. They don't have any money. And so then they get thrown in jail, which means they can't get a job. They can never pay. So it's just, it's a racket, and it's government enforced.
And, of course, you've just had the situation in the States at the moment with this Rockefeller gentleman. That was an alias, I believe, who left the woman and all. That kind of case gets all of the media attention and kind of reinforces the stereotype that, you know, men are changing their names and lying and, you know, false passports and stealing children. And, you know, this is what the male oppressors do, which is just the wrong stereotype. And that gets all the media attention.
Well, exactly. It's much more interesting to imagine the deadbeat as a fellow with a yacht and a
Rockefeller who changes his name.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, at his leisure, and he's let this poor woman on a wild goose chase and stole the child at a supervised, you know, all this sort of. I mean, had it been the mother who'd stolen the child from the father, I mean, firstly.
Well, then we would know that it was justified. We would know that.
We probably wouldn't even have heard about it. You know, wouldn't have made international headlines.
Yeah, no, it's and that's part of my thesis in Save the Males. It's all part of this. I try to shine a light on this constellation of dots. If you connect them all and sort of project into the future, you see where this is going. I mean, men are being sidelined and fathers are being marginalized, and the whole idea is that men are bad and women are good. Men are perpetrators, women are victims, and what's mind-boggling to me is that we seem to be accepting it without much.
It's kind of like deciding that you don't like the foundations of your house because they're down there in the mud and the dirt. So you like all the rest of the house, but you're going to do away with the foundation, and then you wonder why the whole thing ends up in the mud.
Well, and see what happens. This is where it leads. I mean, now you have this group of. My son is 23, so his generation has never grown up in never been in a culture where men were honored and valued, you know, except in crisis. I mean, yeah, we get a 9/11, and we love the firemen, we love the policemen, but, you know, after it's over, we want them to go away. And so now my own son, of course, has grown up in a normal household with reasonable adults. I mean, not perfect, but reasonable. So I don't include him in this, but I do feel that his whole generation has suffered because of this attitude toward guys. Now, what happens when men are not valued and when they are not respected? How long do you think they're going to behave in respectable in ways? I mean, how long would anyone put up with that nonsense? And so what happens is you have these 20-year-old girls, 20-somethings, who can't find a good guy and complain that men are, you know, the guys their age are not considerate, they don't ever pick up the tab, they don't hold the door, they don't this, they don't that. Well, they don't know how, and it's never been expected of them. And so the backlash to all of this, I mean, the serious trickle-down effect is that you have a generation of young men and women who have no idea how to relate to each other, who essentially use each other for immediate gratification. I can't imagine, it's a little bit frightening to me to think, how they are going to form unions and raise children and what kind of children they will be. I mean, now, there's my hope is that they will react to this. They will have come from, they themselves have come from divorced families, and I'm hoping they can recognize this silliness and decide that they're not going to live that way. But at the moment, when I go to college campuses, I hear a great deal about these, you know, from these kids who simply don't have any idea how the family is supposed to look and how it's supposed to act and how the sexes are supposed to interact with each other. Outside of the bedroom, of course. I mean, they know exactly how to, you know, hook up.
Sure.
In New York Minute, but they don't know how to ask the last name.
Incredible. Look, we might just quote Amanda Patel again. It was such a great review. She said by bending over backwards, and she's talking about your arguments, by bending over backwards to make single mothers feel good about themselves, by diminishing the role of fathers, by elevating women as the superior parents, we've gone a considerable way to destroying one of the basic tenets of a successful society, family life. Apart from the effects of this seismic social shift in society, it is also grossly unfair. So can you just talk about that? Of course, on this program, we endlessly see men who have been utterly brutalized by this system.
Yeah. Well, I'm not exactly sure where I'm supposed to come in on that last thing you read. I was when you started, you were talking about the sort of advancing the idea that single motherhood is good. Is that what I'm supposed to be talking about? Is that what you're asking?
Yes, I mean, just the way it's all been promoted, basically.
Well, yeah, this one of the things I talk about in Save the Males is how we have sort of glorified the idea of single motherhood. It's so interesting to me because I come from a different generation when being a single mother was the last thing anybody wanted. You know, many, many hours were spent praying that one would not become a single mother.
Yeah.
So, but now it's completely reversed, and we not only accept single motherhood as just as good as any other family configuration, we simply applaud it, and our media plays a big role in that, in covering what really should be kind of a fringe idea, such as women going online to shop for the father of their child, and I mean that in terms of just a vial of DNA. trying to keep it clean here. And, you know, it's just stunning to, it's actually a larger issue than just single mothers and than the devaluing of fathers. It's a real sort of commodification of human beings and reducing the human relationship to just this exchange of genetic material and then and otherwise feeding our own narcissistic need for whatever we that something that reflects back and validates our sense of self without any real concern for the little person being created. And let me just try to explain that a little bit. Let's say, here is how a New York Times piece was I wrote about that was in a Sunday magazine a couple of years ago. It followed some women around as they pursued their dream father. Now, mind you, no actual exchange of, you know, no meeting of man and woman, no first kiss, no courtship, no fall in love, no marriage, no none of that. Just simply the woman's deciding that she's ready to have a child because she needs that for her own self-fulfillment and goes online, and there are all sorts of, you know, sperm shopping catalogs and websites and whatnot. So some of these would it was kind of ghastly the way they would go about picking their perfect mate. And it was according to things like, I'd like someone with darker pigmentation in their skin because I don't want to have to slather my child with sunblock. Or, you know, I'd like a slender fellow because everybody in my family is a little bit overweight.
Mm.
Or, you know, I want somebody who had high math scores because I was terrible in math. All of that, it's equating the you know.
Yes.
Well, what happens when the child doesn't meet your expectations? When you've gone that far to quantify your idea of the ideal child, then who knows what happens afterwards. So,
all right. We're just about out of time, Kathleen. Can you just close? Where do you think all this will lead? Where are we going with all this?
Well, I think if we don't slam on the brakes, I think we are eliminating the nuclear family. And the big problem with that, of course, is obvious. When you don't have the family in place, then something fills that vacuum. Something has to come in and take care of mother and child, and that's where government steps in. So if we want to become a nation of people who are reliant on the government to dictate our behaviors and run our lives, then we're on the fast track. So somebody needs to wake up and slam on brakes and say, no, what matters is the family, and we're going to figure out how to make that work.
Well, if only. But I wouldn't be holding your breath. We've been talking... It's sad, isn't it? It's terrible, but true.
That's a pessimistic note. Now, come on. No, let's be optimistic.
All right.
Let's be optimistic. Let's say that we're going to talk to the 20-year-olds and help them figure it out. How's that?
All right. Good on you.
All right.
We've been talking with Kat...
Yeah,
thank you so much for coming on to Dad's on the Air. That was Kathleen Parker. She's the US author of a new book, Save the Males. Really lovely person, obviously, and it's a book that's been causing a stir right around the world, Save the Males. Don't forget to get a copy. Now, there's a thing available in all good bookshops and online, I assume.
Amazon.com has it all.
Good on Amazon.
All right, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. We'll be back.
Thank you. gotta be cool, relax, get hit, and get on my tracks. Take a land seat, a hitch home. Take a long ride on the motorbike till I'm ready.
Ready,
raise a little thing all the way.
You're listening to Dad's on the Air. My name's Peter van der Voort, and we're now going to be crossing to New Zealand and speak with Peter Burns. Peter is a very active member of the men's rights movement in New Zealand and runs a very successful website called Dads for Justice. It's well worth visiting. Peter was going to join us a few weeks ago, but unfortunately, due to some technical difficulties, we were unable to do that interview. However, he's with us today. Peter, welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Good. It's great to be here, Peter.
Peter, like all of us, you were probably driven into action after falling victim to an appalling family law industry, which helps to drive a wedge between parents and their children. Can you tell us how it all started for you?
Yeah, it was actually this month in 2001, 7 years ago, and I was at home and I was living in a stable relationship with my partner and a couple of young children, and daughters, and they were 8 and 6 at the time, and I was waiting for them to come return to the family home. They were away on a holiday, and the next thing you know, bang, and the police came, and I found out that there had been protection orders issued, and that was the last time I was a father in the family unit.
Yeah,
it came as out of the blue, no warning, just bang, yeah. It was quite frightening how quickly it came, and I had no control over it, and it was, it's been an ongoing battle ever since.
How did you feel when that was happening, like coming out of the blue like that? How did you feel?
Well, I went from, preparing a meal for my daughter and my partner to come home, and a nice roast meal in the oven, to a prison cell the next day, so, It was, you can't really, it's hard to put into words unless you've experienced it. It's...
Helplessness?
It happens so quick that you struggle. I'm actually struggling for the words to describe it. I just kept saying to myself in the prison cell, this can't be happening. I don't have to worry about anything because I've done nothing wrong and I'll just tell the truth. So, it was just overwhelming.
And you went to court, I take it, to try and get access to your children?
Yes, I've been to court. I've had a couple of hundred court appearances since.
A couple of hundred?
Wow. Yeah, easy.
And do you see your children now, Peter?
Well, Peter, to put the icing on the cake, my eldest daughter, after 6 years of fighting to see her, arrived on my doorstep. July last year, and I've had full custody of her, and it's kind of turned it on its head.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because it either goes that way, where they never see them again, or the children, when they become teenagers, go and search themselves.
Well, that's what she did.
Mm.
14-year-old, she came, she wanted to search, she didn't believe that it was said against me, and she since found out that, the real dad.
So that gives hope to all those who, several years struggle with the fact that they don't see their children, and suddenly there they are, and your case is an example of that.
Definitely. I went from supervised access of seeing them twice a year, in the 6 years I only seen them in 14 two-hour sections, it's not very many, and then I had custody of my eldest daughter there, so it does give hope. The message I'd like to portray is don't give up, men, don't give up, because my daughter came out of the blue. It was, I got a phone call from her. I thought it was a joke, but no, it wasn't. And there's always hope there.
And what about your other daughter? Do you see her at all?
She's still with her mother, and I'm just in the process now. After 7 years, actually to the day, the protection orders, which that were built on false allegations, are going to be withdrawn.
Really?
And once they, because they had to withdraw the protection order last year before my eldest daughter could come and live with me. And since then, I've just been mounting the pressure on the court system, saying, well, the whole lot has just been a whole lot of rubbish. And I have been unrelenting in the last 12 months with the court, and I hear only this week that they're going to accept my application to have a hearing to withdraw these protection orders.
Based on false allegations, it's so easily done, isn't it? It's horrible.
They were based on false allegations of domestic violence and sexual abuse, both of which I proved to be false in the criminal court. But, of course, the family court doesn't need evidence, you see. This is the thing. The balance of probabilities in the family court is enough to warrant judges to exclude your children from your lives. But when charges that arise from the family court end up in the criminal jurisdiction, well, a smart, cocky like myself who's learned the law can easily get them thrown out. But I can't. I just struggle in the family court because it's a totally different operation over there. Yeah.
Peter, you think there's much understanding out in the general community and much support for non-custodial parents?
Unfortunately, Peter, no, there isn't. Because I've talked to barristers about this who keep away from the family court, and they have got good friends that have been done over by the family court, which they cannot help. And now, these are high-profile barristers. And they have said to me, Peter, it is too sad, and the public aren't aware of what's going on in the family court. No, I don't believe that they are. We had some measures that were by the government that were going to open up the family court and make it more accessible to the media. Most people don't know.
I think once the population finds out how bad it is, I think there'll be a groundswell of support. But until the mainstream media gets a better understanding and starts to actually write more articles about it. It's actually interesting. Do you find there's... I've just observed myself that there's more and more women coming out speaking about it. That there's a wonderful author, Kathleen Parker, has just written a book, Save the Males.
Yes, I see that. Yes.
She's going to come on to our program very soon. So, and that's a wonderful book, and they're the sort of things that are coming out. Female writers are starting to write about these things, and I think that might be a breakthrough for us, hopefully. Is there much female support in New Zealand? Is there many women writing?
Yes, well, I have experienced... I've done interviews with Radio New Zealand, a couple of them, and they've been female reporters who've followed up, and we've had quite lengthy conversations, and they are at the situation where they didn't realise it was that bad. And they, not like Kathleen, you know, has come out and that is what I really admire that lady for what she's done, but we are just on the brink of that, I feel. I feel that the government's had a pretty thumbs, you know, if the screws have been down on this, talking about this subject of fathers and fathers' rights. But I do feel that there's a certain air of change about it. I'm optimistic.
Yeah, I am too. I think that's one of the ways we're going to cut through in the end. Peter, you've now got a very successful and informative blog, Dads for Justice, which distributes a wealth of information to the world. What made you decide to start this project, Peter?
Well, I'm an avid writer to the letters to the editor, and I thought, well, there's another tool, and I just started the blog out of frustration. frustration, really, just to try and get the message out there of the inequality and the imbalance, you know. That was basically why I'd done it, you know, and just grown from there.
And is it, do you feel that it was helping you as well during that time that you were actually became proactive, because there's a certain feeling, a total feeling of helplessness and disempowerment, isn't there, when you haven't got access to your children anymore?
I reiterate what you just said then. But being proactive with the blog and the internet in those dark years, 6 years, where I was just facing court battle after court battle, getting nowhere against a system that wouldn't allow me to clear my name of anything. And yes, no, the internet and the blog and the various groups I'm in, you know, Australian Dads groups, a lot of New Zealand groups here. No, it's been, they have been my really support network. Yeah.
That's great. We're speaking with Peter Burns, a men's rights activist from New Zealand. We'll be back after the break.
As sure as the sun in the morning will rise, and the moon casting shadows will follow so wise, we won't stop loving a child that is lost till the end of our days, and no matter what cost. As sure as the shape of a circle is round, and four corners in every square can be found, we love our children, our own flesh and blood, despite our alienation, which came like a flood. Set them free, set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them their rights, so why can't you see? Set them free, set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them a voice, like you and me. As sure as the rising tide will come in, and there's no one on earth who's without sin. As loving fathers for our children we pine, but our spirit's not broken, nor our will in decline. As sure as a peace will be followed by war, and some will be rich, some will be poor, we want to protect our children from harm, but we are prevented and try to stay calm. Set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them their rights, oh, why can't you see? Set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them a voice, like you and me. As sure as in colors, black is not white, and food we must eat to stay healthy and sprite, we won't turn our back on our children we love. Though some days it's hard and the going gets tough, as some will die young and others grow old. Some tell their story while others withhold. As fathers we care and will never give up the love of our children, which some try to obstruct. Set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them their rights, so why can't you see? Set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them a voice, like you and me. Set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them their rights, so why can't you see? Set them free, let it rest, let it be. Give them a voice, like you.
We're back with Dads on the Air. We're back with Peter Burns from New Zealand. Peter, what's happening in New Zealand at the moment. You're leading up to an election. When's the election due?
I think the date is November the 9th, but don't quote me on that, but it'll be early November. Yeah.
Is there's two main parties, isn't there?
Yeah.
And there's the men's rights movement or parenting movement. Do they see any one or the other being more beneficial to their cause?
Yes, good question. Well, Labor, the incumbent government, have been here for 9 years, and they haven't addressed any of the issues put forward by farmers groups, not one of them. So National, the other party, who looks set to go in this time round by a landslide, a huge landslide at that, I think we have more chance with National to try and get some male perspective put back into the way things are running over here. With Labor, they are a minority agenda government. You know, they push for their agendas and that, whereas they're not really interested in mainstream New Zealanders. And of course, that's reflected in the huge amount of fathers that are leaving the country every day. And I believe this year will be a record of people leaving New Zealand. I think a lot of people have just had a gutsful because there just doesn't seem to be any focus on the family in New Zealand anymore. Whether the National government that come in can put the family back up on a pedestal and try and work on keeping it together rather than fracturing, or it will be, hopefully it will be.
The issue of child support, that's one of the big issues in Australia. Well, not only in Australia, it's even worse in America. But the way that they're persecuted by any non-custodial parent, once you become a non-custodial parent, you're basically at the mercy of these organisations and agencies such as the Child Support Agency, and they hound you relentlessly at a time when you're struggling with awful emotional problems and not seeing your children most of the time. Is that the same in New Zealand? Is that one of the main causes?
Unfortunately, it is. It's just to quote an example, my case, my daughter arrived on my doorstep July last year. I've just stopped this month paying child support for last month. It took a year to sort that out. But I have countless fathers that come to me that on the receiving end of family court litigation, they're not happy, and they just go. They leave good jobs because the child support cripples them, and they go to Australia. And, of course, the child support debt follows them.
It does, it does.
And the penalties that these fathers face when they don't do anything about it. But look, this term deadbeat, the National Party family spokesman and both the Labor and National Party are very quick to demonise fathers as deadbeats, label them as, stereotype them as deadbeat fathers because they don't pay child support. None of the child support in New Zealand actually goes to the children. It's another tax. And a lot of fathers say to me, well, I'm working 2 days for income tax, 2 days for child support, the fifth day's for me, it's not worth it. So they go.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Simple as that. It's terrible.
There's millions of fathers are affected worldwide, yet Fathers for Justice seems to be the only fathers group who is prepared to take the issue to the streets. Why do you think there's such apathy amongst the fathers to join in and swell the ranks to where the community will actually realise there's something terribly wrong?
Well, here in New Zealand, I struggle to get people along to protests outside courthouses. I've protested outside Parliament dressed as Batman, regularly outside the court as Judge Dredd dressed up in costume, or Father Christmas at Christmas time, and I don't get support from fathers. And when I do, the pressure that's put on them by the authorities, they soon back off. I don't say that lightly because that sounds. But I can just quote one example. I had a father's protest at the courthouse, and there were actually more government SIS agents there than there was people in attendance.
So why do you think...
Things like that scare people.
So why do you think that normally, I mean, people would go to the streets for a lot less emotive issues than this, and yet why can't we get the fathers out there?
This is what I can't put a finger on it. You know, it's absolute in New Zealand here. Our fathers' movement is all very good on the internet, but when it comes for protest day, I just can't put a finger on that, Peter. Sorry, I don't know whether it's.
Now everybody says this. Everybody says the same thing that they cannot understand why they're not out there by the thousands. Maybe they will be one day.
What I can't understand, if you go back a few years in the 70s, late 60s and 70s, the feminist movement. Now, they right across the world, they really made an impact in a short period of time. Only because they showed a bit of solidarity. I don't believe any of the stuff that they did was beneficial for society, but that doesn't matter. Mm. They showed solidarity and they got something done. Why can't fathers do it?
Yeah, that was interesting because, again, they had many groups that were fighting their own. Same as the civil rights movement in America, the black civil rights movement. In the end, they came together and... maybe we're not quite at that stage yet. There were many different groups working, but they're working separately. I suppose we're all travelling down the same river in separate canoes, and one day, hopefully, that will change. I think I interviewed Tony Coe in Britain last year, and he said it's like herding cats to get men's groups together.
Well, he's right.
Do you think... go ahead.
Really like to see, that, you know, some unity in the... because especially with a new government coming in, we've got a really good chance here as far as to push for some, you know, balance within the state system. And it's just... I talked to some guys that have been at it for 30 years and they say the same thing, you know. Why? Why can't we get these guys together?
Peter, do you think our current child protection laws are compromised by the actions of the family courts, who persist in giving total control over the children to one parent, who is then able to eliminate the other parent from the children's life with ease through the use of false DV accusations or child abuse accusations, for instance, as you've experienced?
Oh, I think it's sad that the power's been given to the custodial parent because... when the power is handed like that, the most insidious thing of the family court, and it's conditioned by what you know, parental alienation. I don't call it a syndrome; I call it a disorder. My daughter is, you know, a year after reuniting with me, I'm still deprogramming her from the poisoning and brainwashing that goes on. And to me, that's the most tragic part of the family court, the most insidious.
I think there's three key elements of why it fails non-custodial parents. One of them is that as parents, we have no legal right to be a parent, or parenting rights. We have no legal parenting rights. So you can't go to court and argue for rights that we don't have. The second one is we're not treated equally. Legally, one becomes a custodial parent, the other one a non-custodial parent, and there's a major difference into the court orders that you receive, how they're interpreted by one or the other. And the third one is there's no enforcement instrumentality. There's nothing to enforce any orders. So the whole thing has failed. Going to court is a wasted exercise as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it is, Peter, yeah. Absolute waste of time. Like, I asked our Minister of Courts in a letter 3 years ago if any female had ever been referred on from the civil jurisdiction of the family court for perjury charges. I'm still waiting on the answer.
Yes. I don't think it's in the court's interest to change anything, because it's a very lucrative outcome for them. Anyone associated with the family law industry is on a guaranteed healthy economic stream.
And just to add to that, in my case, I've had 52 state-appointed lawyers and 19 psychologists.
Good heavens.
You know, that's a lot of money.
Yes, and that's what happens. It drains the family wealth in the end, which the kids that they're supposed to protect, they're cheated out of that money. It goes to the lawyer's kids in the end.
Yep, and I asked my daughter now, what did any of the lawyers and the psychologists, what she think of them? And I don't really like to use the words as she described them, but she's utter contempt anyway.
And does she see her mother
and
now?
To me, that was all a waste of money, wasn't it, really?
Exactly. Does she, your daughter, see her mother at all now?
Yeah, and yes, and I've just got to bite the bullet there. I try and be nice and just forget about
yes.
it. But my beef is not really with her. It's actually with the system that allowed her to do that.
Exactly. That's my sentiments as well.
Yeah.
You know, up to a quarter of the nation's children are currently seeing contact with their families severed with the support and encouragement of a corrupt and secretive international family law industry, something that will undoubtedly have disastrous long-term repercussions for the well-being of our children and the nation. Why is this not even on the radar in the mainstream media, do you think?
Yeah, it does make one wonder, doesn't it? It's, you know, you only have to look at the damage of fatherlessness. You know, in society, it's there for us to see, the lack of role models. You know, for years, for decades now, dads have been demonised, you know, as bumbling idiots. Even you just look at the media and see the ads, you know, making it out to be foolish kits. You know, it's got to balance up, because I see Australia's the same as us, that girls are far outseeding boys in academic levels. You know, it's got to Can't keep going like this.
Peter, do you see this entrenched acceptance in our family courts of allowing the systematic removal of hundreds of thousands of the nation's children from the love, care and protection of their non-custodial parents as a human rights issue or not? Because if not, then what in the hell are we doing here? It is a human rights issue, isn't it?
I brought proceedings with our Human Rights Commission here in Wellington against the family court police and child, youth and family, which is the equivalent, you know, child. And I took it to Wellington, to the Human Rights Review Tribunal, and it was struck out, and I was ordered to pay thousands of dollars in costs. So, just shows you. And they breached, I have many examples of how they've breached virtually every article in the International Covenant of Human Rights.
Yes.
The family court is in total breach of the basic human rights contained in that declaration.
I think most non-custodial parents would agree with you on that one. Well, so
I think they all would, and every one of the non-custodial parents would have a legitimate breach of a basic human right contained in that covenant, I guarantee it.
So what do you think as being the solution to overcome this appalling human rights abuse?
I think that the family courts just got to realise the importance of the influence and the nurturing of the father. Simple as that.
Peter, we're just about out of time. Is there anything you'd like to say to all the dads out there that will inspire them to become more active in order to bring about much-needed change?
Yes, I'd just like to tell all the dads that are suffering from alienation from their children and estrangement, please don't give up. Don't give up. Things are going, there's an air of change out there, I can feel it.
Just before we go, Peter, what's your website details for those that might want to go and visit it, because there's an enormous amount of information on there. So what is it, what's the details on that?
It's just Dad for Justice, DAD in lower caps, and number 4, Justice, and just punch that in and you'll see me.
Dads for Justice, there you go.
Dads for Justice, yeah.
Thank you for joining us, Peter, and much luck with your website, Dads for Justice. And
yeah,
we hope that you will have a successful relationship with your children.
Thank you, Peter.
At first it was a pain, I was petrified, kept thinking I could never live without you by my side. But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong, I'd withdraw. And I don't know how to get along. And so you're back from outer space. I just walked in to find you here with that sad look upon your face. I should have changed that stupid lock. I should have made you leave your key. If I'd have known for just 1 second you'd be back to bother me. Go on now, go. Walk out the door.
Yeah, just turn around now, because you're not welcome anymore. Weren't you the one who tried to hurt me with goodbye? Did you think I'd crumble? Did you think I'd lay down and die? Oh, no, no, I will survive. Oh, as long as I know how to love, I know I'll stay alive. I've got all my life to live. I've got all my love to give. I will survive. I will survive.
Think you better take that.
Did you know I cried?
So that was Dad's on the Air for another week. Hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back next week. You can, of course, check out the show that we've just recorded. It'll be up on our site, which is dadsontheair.net. And there'll be lots of programs from the past up there as well. Thanks for listening. Hope you enjoyed the show. We'll be back next week at 10:30 next Tuesday, going through the news to deal with Father's
Day. We're here because we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.